Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. A Painful Case by James Joyce. Mr. James Duffy lived in Chapelizod because he wished to live as far as possible from the city of which he was a citizen, and because he found all the other suburbs of Dublin mean, modern, and pretentious. He lived in an old sombre house, and from its windows he could look into the disused distillery or upwards along the shallow river on which Dublin is built. The lofty walls of his uncarpeted room were free from pictures. He had himself bought every article of furniture in the room, a black iron bedstead, an iron washstand, four cane chairs, a clothes rack, a coal scuttle, a fender and irons, and a square table on which lay a double desk. A bookcase had been made in an alcove by means of shelves of white wood. The bed was clothed with white bedclothes, and a black and scarlet rug covered the foot. A little hand mirror hung above the washstand, and during the day a white shaded lamp stood as the sole ornament of the mantelpiece. The books on the white wooden shelves were arranged from below upwards according to bulk. A complete Wordsworth stood at one end of the lowest shelf, and a copy of the Maynooth Catechism, sewn into the cloth cover of a notebook, stood at one end of the top shelf. Writing materials were always on the desk. In the desk lay a manuscript translation of Hauptmann's Michael Kramer, the stage directions of which were written in purple ink, and a little sheaf of papers held together by a brass pin. In these sheets a sentence was inscribed from time to time, and in an ironical moment the headline of an advertisement for Bile Beans had been pasted onto the first sheet. On lifting the lid of the desk, a faint fragrance escaped, the fragrance of new cedarwood pencils, or of a bottle of gum, or an overripe apple, which might have been left there and forgotten. Mr. Duffy abhorred anything which betokened physical or mental disorder. A medieval doctor would have called him saturnine. His face, which carried the entire tale of his years, was of the brown tint of Dublin streets. On his long and rather large head grew dry black hair, and a tawny moustache did not quite cover an unamiable mouth. His cheekbones also gave his face a harsh character, but there was no harshness in the eyes, which, looking at the world from under their tawny eyebrows, gave the impression of a man ever alert to greet a redeeming instinct in others, but often disappointed. He lived at a little distance from his body, regarding his own acts with doubtful side glances. He had an odd autobiographical habit which led him to compose in his mind from time to time a short sentence about himself, containing a subject in the third person and a predicate in the past tense. He never gave alms to beggars and walked firmly, carrying a stout hazel. He had been for many years cashier of a private bank in Baggot Street. Every morning he came in from Chapelizod by tram. At midday he went to Dan Burke's and took his lunch, a bottle of lager beer and a small tray full of arrowroot biscuits. At 4 o'clock he was set free. He dined in an eating house in George's Street, where he felt himself safe from the society of Dublin's gilded youth, and where there was a certain plain honesty in the bill of fare. His evenings were spent either before his landlady's piano or roaming about the outskirts of the city. His liking for Mozart's music brought him sometimes to an opera or a concert. These were the only dissipations of his life. He had neither companions nor friends, church nor creed. He lived his spiritual life without any communion with others, visiting his relatives at Christmas and escorting them to the cemetery when they died. He performed these two social duties for old dignity's sake, but conceded nothing further to the conventions which regulate civic life. He allowed himself to think that in certain circumstances he would rob his bank, but as these circumstances never arose, his life rolled out evenly, an adventureless tale. One evening he found himself sitting beside two ladies in the rotunda. The house, thinly peopled and silent, gave distressing prophecy of failure. The lady who sat next to him looked round at the deserted house once or twice and then said, "What a pity there is such a poor house tonight. It's so hard on people to have to sing to empty benches." He took the remark as an invitation to talk. He was surprised that she seemed so little awkward. While they talked, he tried to fix her permanently in his memory. When he learned that the young girl beside her was her daughter, he judged her to be a year or so younger than himself. Her face, which must have been handsome, had remained intelligent. It was an oval face with strongly marked features. The eyes were very dark blue and steady. Their gaze began with a defiant note, but was confused by what seemed a deliberate swoon of the pupil into the iris, revealing for an instant a temperament of great sensibility. The pupil reasserted itself quickly. This half-disclosed nature fell again under the reign of prudence, and her astrakhan jacket, moulding a bosom of certain fullness, struck the note of defiance more definitely. He met her again a few weeks afterwards, at a concert in Earlsford Terrace, and seized the moments when her daughter's attention was diverted to become intimate. She alluded once or twice to her husband, but her tone was not such to make the allusion a warning. Her name was Mrs. Sinico. Her husband's great-grandfather had come from Leghorn. Her husband was captain of a mercantile boat plying between Dublin and Holland, and they had one child. Meeting her a third time by accident, he found courage to make an appointment. She came. This was the first of many meetings. They met always in the evening and chose the most quiet quarters for their walks together. Mr. Duffy, however, had a distaste for underhand ways, and finding that they were compelled to meet stealthily, he forced her to ask him to her house. Captain Sinico encouraged his visits, thinking that his daughter's hand was in question. He had dismissed his wife so sincerely from his gallery of pleasures that he did not suspect that anyone else would take an interest in her. As the husband was often away and the daughter out giving music lessons, Mr. Duffy had many opportunities of enjoying the lady's society. Neither he nor she had any such adventure before, and neither was conscious of any incongruity. Little by little, he entangled his thoughts with hers. He lent her books, provided her with ideas, shared his intellectual life with her. She listened to all. Sometimes, in return for his theories, she gave out some fact of her own life. With almost maternal solicitude, she urged him to let his nature open to the full. She became his confessor. He told her that for some time he had assisted at the meetings of an Irish socialist party, where he had felt himself a unique figure amidst the score of sober workmen in a garret lit by an inefficient oil lamp. When the party had divided into three sections, each under its own leader and its own garret, he had discontinued his attendances. The workmen's discussions, he said, were too timorous. The interest they took in the question of wages was inordinate. He felt that they were hard-featured realists, and that they resented an exactitude which was the product of a leisure not within their reach. No social revolution, he told her, would be likely to strike Dublin for some centuries. She asked him why he did not write out his thoughts. "For what?" he asked her, with careful scorn. "To compete with phrasemongers incapable of thinking consecutively for 60 seconds? To submit himself to the criticisms of an obtuse middle class, which entrusted its morality to policemen and its fine arts to impresarios?" He went often to her little cottage outside Dublin. Often they spent their evenings alone. Little by little, as their thoughts entangled, they spoke of subjects less remote. Her companionship was like a warm soil about an exotic. Many times she allowed the dark to fall upon them, refraining from lighting the lamp. The dark, discreet room, their isolation, the music that still vibrated in their ears, united them. This union exalted him, wore away the rough edges of his character, emotionalized his mental life. Sometimes he caught himself listening to the sound of his own voice. He thought that in her eyes he would ascend to an angelical stature. And, as he attached the fervent nature of his companion more and more closely to him, he heard the strange, impersonal voice, which he recognized as his own, insisting on the soul's incurable loneliness. "We cannot give ourselves," it said. "We are our own." The end of these discourses was that one night, during which she had shown every sign of unusual excitement, Mrs. Sinico caught up his hand passionately and pressed it to her cheek. Mr. Duffy was very much surprised. Her interpretation of his words disillusioned him. He did not visit her for a week. Then he wrote to her, asking her to meet him. As he did not wish their last interview to be troubled by the influence of their ruined confessional, they met in a little cake shop near the park gate. It was cold autumn weather, but in spite of the cold, they wandered up and down the roads of the park for nearly 3 hours. They agreed to break off their intercourse. "Every bond," he said, "is a bond to sorrow." When they came out of the park, they walked in silence towards the tram. But here she began to tremble so violently that, fearing another collapse on her part, he bade her goodbye quickly and left her. A few days later he received a parcel containing his books and music. 4 years passed. Mr. Duffy returned to his even way of life. His room still bore witness of the orderliness of his mind. Some new pieces of music encumbered the music stand in the lower room, and on his shelves stood 2 new volumes by Nietzsche, Thus Spake Zarathustra and The Gay Science. He wrote seldom in the sheaf of papers which lay in his desk. One of his sentences, written 2 months after his last interview with Mrs. Sinico, read, "Love between man and man is impossible, because there must not be sexual intercourse. And friendship between man and woman is impossible, because there must be sexual intercourse." He kept away from concerts lest he should meet her. His father died. The junior partner of the bank retired. And still, every morning, he went into the city by tram, and every evening he walked home from the city, having dined moderately in George's Street, and read the evening paper for dessert. One evening, as he was about to put a morsel of corned beef and cabbage into his mouth, his hand stopped. His eyes fixed themselves on a paragraph in the evening paper, which he had propped against the water carafe. He replaced the morsel of food on his plate and read the paragraph attentively. Then he drank a glass of water, pushed his plate to one side, doubled the paper down before him between his elbows, and read the paragraph over and over again. The cabbage began to deposit a cold white grease on his plate. The girl came over to ask him, was his dinner not properly cooked? He said it was very good, and ate a few mouthfuls of it with difficulty. Then he paid his bill and went out. He walked along quickly through the November twilight, his stout hazel stick striking the ground regularly, the fringe of the buff mail peeping out of a side pocket of his tight reefer overcoat. On the lonely road which leads from the park gate to Chapel Izzard, he slackened his pace. His stick struck the ground less emphatically, and his breath, issuing irregularly, almost with a sighing sound, condensed in the wintry air. When he reached his house, he went up at once to his bedroom, and, taking the paper from his pocket, read the paragraph again by the failing light of the window. He read it not aloud, but moving his lips as a priest does when he reads the prayers. Secreto. This was the paragraph. Death of a lady at Sydney Parade. A painful case. Today, at the City of Dublin Hospital, the deputy coroner, in the absence of Mr. Leverett, held an inquest on the body of Mrs. Emily Sinico, aged 43 years, who was killed at Sydney Parade Station yesterday evening. The evidence showed that the deceased lady, while attempting to cross the line, was knocked down by the engine of the 10 o'clock slow train from Kingstown, thereby sustaining injuries of the head and the right side, which led to her death. James Lennon, driver of the engine, stated that he had been in the employment of the railway company for 15 years. On hearing the guard's whistle, he set the train in motion and, a second or two afterwards, brought it to rest in response to loud cries. The train was going slowly. P. Dunn, railway porter, stated that as the train was about to start, he observed a woman attempting to cross the lines. He ran towards her and shouted, but before he could reach her, she was caught by the buffer of the engine and fell to the ground. A juror: you saw the lady fall? Witness: yes. Police Sergeant Crowley deposed that when he arrived, he found the deceased lying on the platform, apparently dead. He had the body taken to the waiting room, pending the arrival of the ambulance. Constable 57E corroborated. Dr. Halpin, assistant house surgeon of the City of Dublin Hospital, stated that the deceased had two lower ribs fractured and had sustained severe contusions of the right shoulder. The right side of the head had been injured in the fall. The injuries were not sufficient to have caused death in a normal person. Death, in his opinion, had been probably due to shock and sudden failure of the heart's action. Mr. H.B. Patterson Finlay, on behalf of the railway company, expressed deep regret at the accident. The company had always taken every precaution to prevent people crossing the lines, except by the bridges, both by placing notices in every station and by the use of patent spring gates at level crossings. The deceased had been in the habit of crossing the lines late at night from platform to platform, and in view of certain other circumstances of the case, he did not think the railway officials were to blame. Captain Sinico of Leoville's Sydney Parade, husband of the deceased, also gave evidence. He stated that the deceased was his wife. He was not in Dublin at the time of the accident, as he had arrived only that morning from Rotterdam. They had been married for 22 years and had lived happily until about 2 years ago, when his wife began to be rather intemperate in her habits. Miss Mary Sinico said that of late her mother had been in the habit of going out at night to buy spirits. She, witness, had often tried to reason with her mother and had induced her to join a league. She was not at home until an hour after the accident. The jury returned a verdict in accordance with the medical evidence and exonerated Lennon from all blame. The deputy coroner said it was a most painful case and expressed great sympathy with Captain Sinico and his daughter. He urged on the railway company to take strong measures to prevent the possibility of similar accidents in the future. No blame attached to anyone. Mr. Duffy raised his eyes from the paper and gazed out of his window on the cheerless evening landscape. The river lay quiet beside the empty distillery, and from time to time a light appeared in some house on the Lucan Road. What an end! The whole narrative of her death revolted him, and it revolted him to think that he had ever spoken to her of what he held sacred. The threadbare phrases, the inane expressions of sympathy, the cautious words of a reporter won over to conceal the details of a commonplace, vulgar death, attacked his stomach. Not merely had she degraded herself, she had degraded him. He saw the squalid tract of her vice miserable and malodorous. His soul's companion. He thought of the hobbling wretches whom he had seen carrying cans and bottles to be filled by the barman. Just God, what an end! Evidently, she had been unfit to live, without any strength of purpose, an easy prey to habits, one of the wrecks on which civilization has been reared. But that she should have sunk so low. Was it possible he had deceived himself so utterly about her? He remembered her outburst of that night, and interpreted it in a harsher sense than he had ever done. He had no difficulty now in approving of the course he had taken. As the light failed and his memory began to wander, he thought her hand touched his. The shock which had first attacked his stomach was now attacking his nerves. He put on his overcoat and hat quickly and went out. The cold air met him on the threshold. It crept up into the sleeves of his coat. When he came to the public house at Chapel Lizard Bridge, he went in and ordered a hot punch. The proprietor served him obsequiously, but did not venture to talk. There were 5 or 6 working men in the shop discussing the value of a gentleman's estate in County Kildare. They drank at intervals from their huge pint tumblers and smoked, spitting often on the floor and sometimes dragging the sawdust over their spits with their heavy boots. Mr. Duffy sat on his stool and gazed at them without seeing or hearing them. After a while, they went out and he called for another punch. He sat a long time over it. The shop was very quiet. The proprietor sprawled on the counter, reading the Herald and yawning. Now and again a tram was heard swishing along the lonely road outside. As he sat there living over his life with her, and evoking alternately the 2 images in which he now conceived her, he realised that she was dead, that she had ceased to exist, that she had become a memory. He began to feel ill at ease. He asked himself what else could he have done. He could not have carried on a comedy of deception with her. He could not have lived with her openly. He had done what seemed to him best. How was he to blame? Now that she was gone, he understood how lonely her life must have been, sitting night after night alone in that room. His life would be lonely too until he too died. Ceased to exist. Became a memory. If anyone remembered him. It was after 9 o'clock when he left the shop. The night was cold and gloomy. He entered the park by the first gate and walked along under the gaunt trees. He walked through the bleak alleys where they had walked 4 years before. She seemed to be near him, in the darkness. At moments, he seemed to feel her voice touch his ear, her hand touch his. He stood still to listen. Why had he withheld life from her? Why had he sentenced her to death? He felt his moral nature falling to pieces. When he gained the crest of Magazine Hill, he halted and looked along the river towards Dublin, the lights of which burned redly and hospitably in the cold night. He looked down the slope and at the base, in the shadow of the wall of the park, he saw some human figures lying. Those venal and furtive loves filled him with despair. He gnawed the rectitude of his life. He felt that he had been outcast from life's feast. One human being had seemed to love him, and he had denied her life and happiness. He had sentenced her to ignominy, a death of shame. He knew that the prostrate creatures down by the wall were watching him and wished him gone. No one wanted him. He was outcast from life's feast. He turned his eyes to the grey gleaming river winding along towards Dublin. Beyond the river he saw a goods train winding out of Kingsbridge station, like a worm with a fiery head, winding through the darkness, obstinately and laboriously. It passed slowly out of sight, but still he heard in his ears the laborious drone of the engine, reiterating the syllables of her name. He turned back the way he had come, the rhythm of the engine pounding in his ears. he began to doubt the reality of what memory told him. He halted under a tree and allowed the rhythm to die away. He could not feel her near him in the darkness, nor her voice touch his ear. He waited for some minutes, listening. He could hear nothing. The night was perfectly silent. He listened again. Perfectly silent. He felt that he was alone.
And that was A Painful Case by James Joyce from his Dubliners collection. Before I speak briefly about this story, I want to take advantage of the fact that I have you now on the hook, and I will hope that you won't turn me off, because I want to take a minute or two to ask you for some help in terms of tangible contributions to making this show continue. It's simple, really. There are some wonderful people who give on a regular basis via a monthly donation, which, as far as I'm concerned, makes them the producers of this show. And I do want to give them a credit for that. And I'm looking into a way of doing that, exactly that, via making them a named producer on IMDb or on some other platform like that. And I do need, it's long overdue, to do at least one episode, which is a kind of a shout out. I'll also be inviting those people, after we get to the next sort of landmark episode, to make suggestions for the beginning of the following season in terms of what stories they would like to hear. Those people are wonderful, and without those people there would be no The Great Stories. It is as simple as that. This is not a free thing to do. Too many people expect that things will be free. The best stuff is not free. There's a huge amount of stuff out there. Some of it is actually reasonably decent, which is available for nothing. And I've found that most of the stuff that's available for nothing, in inverted commas, will often have huge amounts of money behind it. Or some umbrella company or some source of finance, which sadly is not accessible to me. I have no idea why anyone would want to put loads of ads in their podcast, why they would want to do a weird ad read in the middle of their show for MeUndies or some mattress company or some box of food that comes to you in a little white van every week. That will not be a thing that ever happens on my show. I will never do that. I don't want ads either side of this. I don't want to be on any platform like Acast or any of those ones. Nothing wrong with those. God bless them. But I don't want to be part of it. Call me a purist. Call me an imbecile. Call me what you will. But this show will never be that. So, we come around to the simple reason why I'm speaking to you now. Two podcast pioneers who I admire greatly in terms of the work that they've done over the years, Adam Curry and John C. Dvorak, with their show No Agenda, they pioneered the concept of value for value. And basically, what that means is, if you think this show is worth something, if it did something for you by way of entertaining you, making you think, inspiring you to go and read a book, which made a difference in your life, whatever it happens to be, what was that worth to you? Was it worth something that you can make into a tangible financial amount and throw it up the internet to me via greatstoriespod.com, where you can sign on as one of the wonderful, wonderful sustaining producers of the show, without whom there would be no show, or as one of the many wonderful one-off donations. Again, hugely important in the continuing existence of this show. And we're right on the edge here, guys. And I understand that an awful lot of people who have huge, huge audiences will often only have about 1% to 2% of people who will contribute. At that rate, I would be scuppered. And I understand that I'm punching way above with the rate of people who contribute to this show, and I appreciate them immensely. And just to say to you, I'm not sure how this is going to work out, but there will be an acknowledgement of you in some way that's very tangible. But We need a whole lot more. We need a whole lot more. The costs have gone through the roof for hosting, for the continuing of everything to do with maintaining a website online and maintaining a hugely growing show. You may have noticed I don't tend to do 15-minute podcasts. That requires bandwidth, that requires storage, that requires hosting. And every time I add to the thing, I find myself almost punching into a new bracket with each and every show. Certainly it's felt like that over the last while. I've gone through into two separate brackets over the last three shows. And that isn't free. And sadly, I am not some wealthy layabout who can manage to just do this as a hobby. It's not a frickin' hobby. I'm serious about this. If the world was fair, this is all I would be doing with my time, because I actually feel it's really worthwhile. And I think if I could do this, tell people stories, holy crap, what a way to be living. What a way to be living my life. But that's a million miles away. It's a pipe dream at the moment. What I do need is an opportunity for it to at least continue to be, so that people can benefit from what is not my work. It's me presenting fantastic work that challenges your mind, that entertains you, that makes you ask questions about the nature of life and existence and your own way of viewing the world. If that's not worth something, I don't know what is. At this stage, if you're thinking that this is some sort of begging session, you're probably not for me and I'm probably not for you. That's not what this is. This is an honest admission that I'm not really sure how I'm going to keep this thing going without further support. If you're capable of doing it, greatstoriespod.com gives you the opportunity to, and I would appreciate it immensely. This is the year, the next 12 months. This is when Great Stories happens or does not happen in terms of furthering what it is and what it can be. It's got to grow or it's got to go away. I really don't want it to go away. I haven't been prouder of anything ever. It's not just because it's my own idea. It's more than that. It feels like more than that. And it feels like it's been worth more than that to a lot of people. So if you are in that bracket and you can help in some way, I would ask you to do that without any shame or embarrassment on my part. I'm just telling you that I think it's valuable. And if you feel that there is value in it too, then perhaps you could send some of that value back my way. It really is as simple as that. Mr. James Duffy, who lives in Chapel Izzard. He's an interesting lad, isn't he? I found myself really enjoying this story because it was a long time since I'd read it. For some reason, it was one of the ones I'd skipped over in my readings over the years. And there were parts of it that took me by surprise. I remembered it being very impactful the first time I read it. And again, the second time I read it, maybe the third time I read it, which would have been all around the same era. And we're talking a long time ago when I was a student, you know, back in the 1870s. And the power of it really hit me right square between the eyes again here. Because like with all the other stories in Dubliners, we've already discussed Evelyn here on the Great Stories. And if you are one of those lovely, lovely people who have been good enough to pay a monthly subscription for some period of time, you had access to Araby as well. And the thing that connects all three stories, and in fact all the tales in the collection that is Dubliners, is this notion of paralysis. The idea of these desperate, lonely, frustrated individuals who long deeply within themselves for something different, but cannot, because of convention, because of societal norms, because of their own failings, weakness, fear, anxiety, inadequacy, whatever it happens to be, they cannot take the step to adventure, the step to commitment, the step to a whole potential new world. The scene in Evelyn that we've already discussed previously where she's standing there and she literally can't make herself go and be with her love and get on the ship and restart her life and live this grand adventure. And here, Mr. Duffy, who possibly has a name that might suggest darkness. It could be from that origin of dove, which is the Gaelic for black or dark. And maybe he is a benighted soul in his own way, Mr. Duffy. I think there's absolutely lots of evidence in it. We'll come to that in a second. But he can't make himself take that next step of being able to field an excess of emotion, as he deems it at least, from his lover, Mrs. Sinico, when she seems to be overwhelmed and demonstrative in her expression of emotion. He can't manage that. When they're both sitting in a darkened room and he's expounding on his theories and she's being so receptive to them and the audience that he obviously craves for his notions, you get the impression he's possibly a bit of a blowhard, certainly a guy who is very certain of his own rectitude and correctness, at least outwardly. And in Mrs. Sinico, he's found his perfect partner, someone who shares at least some of his interests culturally and listens to him and is supportive and is encouraging. But once they step out of the darkened room and they've stopped meeting stealthily and the relationship has built up to a point where he thought that in her eyes he would ascend to an angelical stature, you know. I love that. Because which of us hasn't at some point been in that relationship where we've been lucky enough to perhaps have had a partner in that relationship who is, if not quite adoring, then very much admiring of you and your ideas and your thoughts or some aspect of you, even at physical beauty or whatever it happens to be. Which of us haven't, when and if we've been lucky enough to be in that position, enjoyed that and had that feeling of elevation that comes from that kind of adoration? You know, when we're told that the dark, discreet room, their isolation, the music that still vibrated in their ears united them. This union, we hear, exalted him, wore away the rough edges of his character, emotionalized his mental life. Yeah, fantastic. But Duffy has a limit to how much emotion he can get in, how much emotion he can endure that he finds appropriate. But sometimes in this state, as he, quote, attached the fervent nature of his companion more and more closely to him, he heard the strange impersonal voice, which he recognized as his own, insisting on the soul's incurable loneliness. We cannot give ourselves, it said. We are our own. So always within him, there is, even in these moments of great, great, great closeness and, you know, this sort of, like I say, heightened state of exalted state of connection that he feels, still his voice is telling him, whoa, whoa, put on the brakes. We can't commit here. We cannot do this. The soul's incurable loneliness. You couldn't think of a better phrase to sum up Dubliners than that. And the way that the relationship collapses, the end of these discourses, as Joyce puts it, is basically poor Mrs. Sinico shows signs of, and again I quote, unusual excitement, that she was guilty of being demonstrably emotional. And it's such a small thing. She catches up his hand passionately and presses it to his cheek. And Duffy, he's frozen by this. You know, you can just imagine the soul told you, we can't have this. Abort, abort, walk away, walk away. And he doesn't visit her for a week because The way in which she interpreted his words disillusioned him. There's no need for that kind of, you know, overwrought emotional response, is what Duffy's saying. And so they meet again sometime later, is it a week or so? And because he doesn't want their last interview to be troubled by the influence of their ruined confessional. So they have this little meeting in the cake shop in Parkgate, and they go walking for 3 hours through the park, and they agree to break off their intercourse. And I love this line, "Every bond," he said, "is a bond to sorrow." You know, this dour, priggish, oafish man with his inability to be emotionally honest is literally taking out, and I imagine he would have like a little pocket Derringer. I think that's the gun that would be appropriate for Mr. Duffy here. And shooting himself square in his big toe. It's an incredible act of self-sabotage. And of course, the outrageous fallout is kind of the point of the story. Because 4 years pass, and he's out and he's living his drab life again. And it is drab. And it's a routine life. And there's nothing wrong with routine. And there's nothing wrong with predictability. But you get the impression with Duffy, it's this sort of almost false stoicism, this kind of, you know, prim and proper attitude to what is correct and what is not correct. The fact that he never even changes the place he eats, all those kind of things. And when he discovers in the paper some 4 years later that Mrs. Sinico is dead, well, what's he going to do with that information? Aside altogether from the fact that this poor broken-hearted woman, as we discover through the very ingenious device that is the newspaper article which he reads and which Joyce can transcribe, because again, think about this as an authorial device. It's not fantastic. Because all you can do, really, so far he can present the story from, you know, the character's point of view, but how could Duffy know the details of Mrs. Sinico's life, her descent into alcoholism and despair, if it was not for this newspaper article, which kind of neatly fills in all the exposition required and gives us all this other colour and shade in terms of the husband's attitude, the daughter's attitude, the general perception of this lady as someone who had become, you know, almost, you can imagine using the word degenerate or something like that. This poor broken-hearted woman who had no love from her husband, who had been discarded by him a long time since, who had thought she had found someone perfect in Duffy and vice versa, but was denied by Duffy's inability to be emotionally honest, to at least accept emotional honesty from her. The other thing, of course, that unites all of the stories of Dubliners is the concept of epiphany, the moment of revelation, of understanding, when concepts clarify. Joyce loves this. He loves that. It's central to most of his early work, is this idea of these moments of epiphany where the world is laid bare in its essence, or some concept becomes clear and clarified and crystallized. And of course, I forgot to mention The Dead, which is also there behind my little paywall over on greatstoriespod.com, which is possibly the greatest of all the stories and one of the greatest short stories in all of literature. The initial reaction, of course, of Duffy is to be self-serving and have this kind of priggish disdain for what he saw as the details of a commonplace, vulgar death. And this, of course, we're told, attacked his stomach. You know, he's distressed by it. He's disapproving of what has become of her. And more than that, it's such a selfish reaction that he is offended by it. I mean, he says at one point, well, we're given to believe that he thinks that she had been unfit to live, without any strength of purpose, an easy prey to habits, one of the wrecks on which civilization has been reared. But it gets worse. He wonders how she could have sunk so low. Was it possible he had deceived himself so utterly about her? He remembered her outbursts of that night and interpreted it in a harsher sense than he had ever done. He had no difficulty now in approving of the course he had taken. I love that, because that is exactly how you'd expect Duffy in his self-righteous smugness to react. To justify, in a moment of shock, the absolutely atrocious fate of Mrs. Sinico, and to be abhorred by it and her, and to entrench himself in his position that yes, he was right in his understanding of her and what she was. But now we come to the slow but very definite epiphany, because he takes himself out, he goes for a drink, he sits in the pub and he listens to the workmen speak and watches them, but he's not really there. He's sitting there, living over his life with her and evoking alternately the two images in which he now conceived her. He realized that she was dead, that she had ceased to exist, and that she had become a memory. And like so many of us, when we're faced with bereavement, we go through those stages, you know, denial and anger and all the rest of them. And his first one was that anger and that self-righteousness. And it's a kind of denial too, because it's such a selfish, horrible reaction that it presupposes she is still around. Only now, later, does it dawn on him that she is, like I said, a memory. And so, realizing that, he goes through the next stage, which is, this isn't my fault, I didn't do anything, you can't blame it on me, the whole Bart Simpson routine, right? He could not have carried on a comedy of deception with her, he could not have lived with her openly, he had done what seemed to him best, how was he to blame? But the epiphany is not over, the epiphany has barely begun. This is just another phase, another stage. Later at 9, as he walks home, he's walking through the bleak alleys where they had walked 4 years before. And we're told she seemed to be near him in the darkness. At moments he seemed to feel her voice touch his ear, her hand touch his. He stood still to listen. Why had he withheld life from her? Why had he sentenced her to death? He felt his moral nature falling to pieces. Now we're getting there. Now we have the honesty. Now we're seeing the guilt, which would absolutely be, you would imagine, what would come to an awful lot of us first if we were in Duffy's position. But he has to work through all this to get there. But the epiphany is occurring. The revelation is occurring. He's understanding his role in what became of Mrs. Sinico. And then there's this little moment at the end where he comes across the lovers lying down beside the wall, and they see him and he sees them, and they're referred to by Joyce in this perfectly Joycean way as being venal and furtive lovers, and the sight of them fills him with despair, and it's only because he understands what he has missed out on. You know, this is what I love about Joyce. It's raw and it's a gut punch. And right there, amongst every other thing that he's feeling, oh my God, I missed out on in my life. And you feel like there's a good chance that this was possibly the only chance he would have had of physical intimacy in his life. And he understands the heft of what it is that he has lost. One human being, we're told, had seemed to love him, and he had denied her life and happiness. He had sentenced her to ignominy, a death of shame, and he knew that the prostrate creatures down by the wall were watching him and wished him gone. No one wanted him. He was an outcast from life's feast. Now, has he lurched into self-pity, or is he finally understanding the fact that yes, indeed, he is an outcast from life's feast? He will not engage with people. His sense of superiority, which is indicated all the way back in line one, where we are told that Duffy lived in Chapel Izzard because it was different to all the other suburbs of Dublin, which he found to be mean, modern, and pretentious. This is a man who has separated himself out from life, from his peers, from his very society and city, And he is suffering now on the back of having alienated almost everybody, of having crafted for himself this incredibly solitary existence. He is understanding the absolute magnitude of the opportunity that he lost, of the impact of his actions on Mrs. Sinico, who also understood the magnitude of the opportunity that she had lost. Her way of dealing with it was her way of dealing with it. I don't think any of us could judge that poor lady who was just broken by it all emotionally. And as he walks away in the darkness, he's described as being a bit like, we're supposed to, I think, be a little bit like the train, which is moving obstinately and laboriously, slowly passing out of sight. Hard not to see that as a metaphor for Duffy and his own sort of uninspired way that he's going to trudge through life to death. And as he walks, he can hear in his ears the laborious drone of the engine reiterating the syllables of her name. It's almost like he's being haunted by his decision, by his loss, by her death. And as the walk concludes, he gets to a stage where he stops under a tree and he can hear the rhythm dying away. And now he could not feel her near him in the darkness, nor her voice touch his ear. He waited for some minutes listening. He could hear nothing. The night was perfectly silent. He listened again. Perfectly silent. He felt that he was alone. And poor old Duffy, he was. It doesn't get much better than Jimmy Joyce, if you ask me. I just love the way he crafts a sentence and a story and a character. And when you're presented with proper genius, it's very, very easy to fanboy like I'm doing. But, you know, you'll forgive me. I'm enthusiastic. And so I want to share that enthusiasm with you. Hope you enjoyed this one. Thanks for indulging my little request at the start of this. And stay tuned, because next up is Kevin Barry again. You may see a pattern here. I do the guys and the gals that I really like. So we do have repeats. And it's not supposed to be a smorgasbord. It's not supposed to be. It doesn't necessarily have any sort of political agenda, this show, in terms of representation or whatever. I would love that to be the case, but I'm not going to drive the bus directly there. It has to be a story that I've read and that I've found to be powerful and that I want to share with you. And I think so far we've got a nice cross section there. I was feeling patriotic on the back of Paddy's Day, so I wanted to do two good Irishmen to launch us back into the make or break stage for the great stories. It's been good to be back with you. Thank you for your support. Tell people about the show and mind yourselves.